United Nations Radio now presents the distinguished actor, Mr. Albert Dekker, in a special dramatic performance, The Story of Nicholas Mitytich.
In a few moments, I shall be speaking to you as Nicholas Mitytich, a refugee from Camp Pasch on the outskirts of Salzburg in Austria. You may like to hear a short extract of a broadcast Mitytich himself recorded a short while ago, as it may help to bring you nearer to his personality and character. He speaks in French, as he did not know English, but I shall translate as we go along.
Murmura les terbons. Peut-être c'est ma voix qui me tienne. Peut-être c'est mon mentalité, mon caractère tel que je ne prends jamais une chose de très mauvaise côté. Je pense toujours.
My morale is good. Because I have faith, because I never see the worst side of things. I always think there will be better times ahead. I have read about people in my situation who thought of suicide. I never. I have reconciled myself with my fate. It is difficult sometimes, but I live.
United Nations Radio, in cooperation with the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, presents Albert Dekker as Mitytich.
Your name?
Nicholas Mitytich.
Age?
38.
Profession?
Lawyer.
Position in your former country?
District Commissioner.
Health?
Good.
And any other qualifications?
I speak four languages. My name is Mitytich. Nicholas Mitytich. It is written on the cover of many files, on the papers inside these files. Name, age, profession, health, personal history. And these files rest in consulates, in immigration offices, and with people who have been trying to help me, in many filing cabinets marked under the letter M. There my name is just another case. A case perhaps more difficult to solve than others. But in the country where I come from, the name Mitytich stood for something, at least in the province and in the small town where I was born. For centuries, there had always been a Mitytich to attach his name to some work for our people. I was brought up, having it hammered into me that I had to live up to the family tradition. In fact, after I completed my studies, I entered the government service, and when I was 30, was appointed district commissioner in our town. I was a man with a solid career, who could one day hope to hold high positions. I married, bought a home, had servants. My wife and I were happy. Perhaps not so happy as I thought we were at the time. But after all these years, I don't know. She, like my life in my hometown, is a vision of the past, a picture seen in a cracked mirror. The world in which I lived, which had grown on traditions hundreds of years old, which from my boyhood I saw as an order of society as natural as leaves on a tree, exists no more, except in the memories of those who remember. And with this world has gone the man Mitytich, whose name meant something. Now it is a name written in indelible ink on a gray piece of cardboard which I have nailed on the door of my room. There it has been for the best part of the last 13 years. My room has one window and wooden walls. It is 9 by 12 feet. There is an iron bed. A cupboard closed with a curtain, a small wooden table, one chair, and a little black stove. On this black stove, I have a water kettle. I have a teapot and two cups in case there is a visitor. I have one plate, three spoons, a fork and two knives. An alarm clock stands on the wooden table. On the wall hangs a calendar, witness of time passing. I am a man who has to live on charity, on 300 shillings a month, Austrian shillings, that is, or about $12. With this, I pay my food, my cigarettes, and such other things as I may need. I have not to pay for light, for coal, or for rent of the room. From my window, I see rows of other barracks. Above the black roof, the gray smoke curling from the chimneys, I can see the mountains. And to the east, the spires of the churches and the dome of the Cathedral of Salzburg not far away. My neighbors are old people, invalids, middle-aged men and women, and their children. Often I think, what are we but the stragglers of an army that passed and has gone? An army of men and women who have found what they needed, a place to live decently, a job, and a home. But I have not found that. I am a man who can call nothing his own but his name and his memories. Would I, knowing what I now know, would I still take the decision I took that June day in 1945? The answer is yes. Yes. It was not the ambitious district commissioner thinking of his career who made the decision, but a man who had changed. I had gone through the war, fighting, killing, and seeing my brothers die, living the nightmare of attack, retreat, defeat, a hunted animal, and finally a prisoner in a cage. It was in 1941 that I was made a prisoner of war. I emerged from the days of soldiering and the first bewilderment of the captured man. Even in the suffering of physical discomforts and the anxieties of exile, the prisoner of war lives on hope. He has time to think. He sees his country no longer from within, beheld from the threshold of his ambition. He sees it more clearly as an expression of a way of life that is inherently good, but which can and must be improved. The future is not a stretch of time in which he plays above all a part for his own benefit. It is a deep wave that must carry better things forward for himself and for all the others who are his people. That was the frame of mind in which I was when war came to an end. The end of the war affected us prisoners in different ways. There were those who went wild with rejoicing, and those who suddenly came to realize that the old traditions in our countries were swept away for new ideas and methods, for a way of life we could not accept. What to do? This was the crucial and personal question which each of us had to answer. I gave it that day in June 1945 when we left our prisoner of war camp and were taken to a place near the border where we faced a group of officers from our own country wearing uniforms we did not know. One of them spoke to us.
Your country wants you back. Your friends wait for you.
From where we stood, we could see the land stretching out toward the mountains, some 30 miles away, the mountains of our country. It was a clear day with a warm sun, yet there was snow on the peaks, and we knew that behind those mountains were the villages and towns where our own people lived, our wives and children. We stood in silence,
What can you expect?
No man asked his neighbor what he was going to do.
Only misery,
no friend
anger,
took counsel
poverty.
From his friend.
Your own country gives you the chance of a new start.
But when the officer stopped speaking, I remained silent. This was the moment of decision. The man who did not go back now would never see his family again. Not his wife, not his children, not his father, not his mother. I refused to return, and so did the others. We had to make this sacrifice to give deeper meaning to everything in which we believed.
Your name?
Nicholas Mitatich.
Age?
38.
Profession?
Lawyer.
Position in your former country?
District Commissioner.
Health?
Good.
Any other qualifications?
I speak four languages. My name goes into a file. My personal history is written down. Resettlement officers come from many countries, and always the same procedure.
Your name?
Nicholas Mitatich.
Age?
39.
Name?
Nicholas Mitatich.
Age?
40.
Name?
Nicholas Mitatich.
Age?
41. And at the end of every interview...
Sorry, but we don't need lawyers.
But I am ready to do anything. Work in a shop, clean offices, be a messenger boy, anything.
Sorry, but we cannot help you. Next, please.
Yes, the farmers, the shoemakers, the road workers, the foresters, the mechanics, provided they were strong in body and limb, could go. Every day some of them parted, and we stood around wishing them Godspeed, thinking one day we shall be lucky. If I had seen more clearly in myself, recognized realities, maybe I would have known then that my future was not over the seas. But hope, false hope, illusions, can be as destroying as drugs. They befog the mind, rob you of your judgment. The shock came when I heard the death of my wife, my mother, father. For long there had been no news. Then a Red Cross card brought the tidings. Now I was truly alone, but I lived. And I still had to make something of this life. I must get away from this camp. For days I walked about thinking. The road that had brought me so far had abruptly ended. Everything I had prepared myself for, everything I had learned, everything I knew could help me no longer. I was standing in front of an abyss with no bridge in sight. I had tried to make some money by helping to dig ditches, build roads. I was not strong enough to become a manual laborer. I was not clever enough with my hands to become a mechanic. What could I do? Perhaps someday, one country would be needing a tailor. I reckoned without fate. But first, I must tell you about Julia. It was in May 1952 that I saw her for the first time. I was sitting in front of my barrack with Ravotich, listening to Vedorov play on his guitar. Dusk was falling. In the far-off courtyard, some children were still playing, but most had gone to bed. A few other families sat out in the open. And then I saw the girl. She was wearing a long gray coat and a white blouse that made a pleasant contrast with her tanned skin and her fair hair. She looked not more than 18, although, as I learned later, she was 20. She came toward us, and Ravotich got up, his face beaming. He introduced her as his fiancée, something very strange happened to me. Like the others, I rose to greet her. But as she and Ravotish walked away, it was as if all my loneliness and all the uselessness of my life was burning deep inside me, like being focused by a magic lens on one point. I think I must have fallen in love with her straight away. Ravotich told me her story a few days later. She had come from her country 2 months earlier. He had known her in his village as a little girl. Now they planned to go to Canada together. I saw much of Julia the following weeks. Ravotich and I were good friends. He lived in a room next to mine. It was natural, therefore, that we should be together during the evenings. Sometimes he and I went to the community hall where Julia had started to train a choir. She had been a teacher, and she herself had a pretty voice. I don't think either Julia or Ravotich noticed my feelings at this time. I did not want them to. This was a burden I had to carry alone. It would have been wrong to complicate their lives. Ravotich had a future, and I had none. Not yet. But we reckoned without fate. One day the social worker came excitedly to see Ravotich. She brought with her his final papers for the visa, the tickets for his journey, the letters of introduction to his sponsor in Canada. A visa can be the key to a new life. It can also be the source of a deep conflict. In some families, it marks the moment of joyful packing. In others, it causes a heart-burning search. All can go except the child, except the father, except the grandmother, because of bad eyesight, a weak heart, a spot on the lung, an illness, described in the regulations as reasons for barring their entry. The family asks themselves, will they leave the one behind, or will they all stay and forego their chance? The situation was not so bad for Ravotich. He was not yet married to Julia. There was no reason why Julia should not join him later, after she had spent the minimum 2 years that have to be spent waiting in a camp before the visa can be granted. And so Ravotich went. After he had gone, Julia and I continued to see each other. Because she was lonely, perhaps, she would come and mend my socks and clothes for me, cook my dinner, spend some evenings with me. Until then, my meals had been very simple. Pour water into a kettle, boil the water, make tea, buy a loaf of bread, a piece of butter, breakfast, lunch, dinner. But now, Julia brought order into my life and companionship and the challenge of another mind. Understand me, I love Julia, but I tried to hide my feelings. I was much older than she, and she was the girl of my friend. Yet in Julia herself, a kind of affection grew, a gentleness towards someone who maybe gave her a feeling of security. She would linger by my side, touch my hand, and one night she stayed. In a camp where men and women feel cut off from the rest of the world, where there is so little to which one can cling, the presence of a friend takes the place of everything. All the absent ones. All the memories of the past.
Name?
Nicholas Mitatich.
Age?
48.
Profession?
Tailor.
Through this door, please. The doctor will see you.
The humming of an X-ray machine.
Come back in 2 days' time.
And 2 days later...
Sorry, but you have a patch on the lung. No visa.
I could have asked of Julia the sacrifice I had no right to accept. She would have stayed with me. Married me. Even to living years and years in this camp. But what would her love have become if on it she would have to blame later the loss of her youth and of her future? What I did is quickly told. I wrote to Ravitich. I told him the truth of what had happened. I implored him to do what he could for Julia, to be her sponsor, so that she might receive a visa. 6 months later, the visa came. She left Camp Pasch for Canada. The photograph of her marriage is on the wall of my room. I read somewhere that when the spirit of a man dies, his body withers. A few weeks after Julia had gone, I had my first heart attack. Then the signs of a crippling rheumatism appeared. I was sent to a sanatorium. My heart got better, but the rheumatism worsened. When I returned to the camp, I was a cripple who needed two sticks to walk. I was broken in body and in mind. There is not much I can say about the time passing in the camp. I cared too little to notice anything going on around me, but somewhere in my subconscious, not everything had gone dead. It was Christmas 1955 when I attended service at our church, surrounded by other people like myself, when I became aware of a great peace, a contentment almost, because I was allowed to worship, to be present at the great mystery of religion, and to receive the gift of this chant and music. Like in an illuminated book of hours, it was suddenly revealed to me that life was not only the power to achieve, but the blessing of thinking, speaking, and being at one with others. It was not waiting for death, as I believed, but the growing awareness of all the thoughts in one's heart. Life is like the icon of the Holy Trinity, love, faith, and charity. And love is the greatest of them all. I did not at once return to life. The moment of peace passed, and again I was plunged in gloom and bitterness. Yet, times returned when I could smile again and laugh. Some weeks later, the social worker came to my room for a long chat. She came to tell me that our camp had been adopted by people in England and in Belgium. They wanted someone to tell them about the needs in the camp and to advise them how they could best help. They wanted a refugee to do this. And the social worker asked whether I would do it. I accepted. Until now, I had been concerned with my own fate only. Every thought of mine, every feeling, had been about the man Mitotich. Now I had to learn about the worries and the anxieties of others, to listen to their histories and experiences, and try to gain their confidence. It was at this time that the churches, the Jews, the Catholics, and Protestants, together with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, began working on a plan to help all the families living in the camp. In many cases, I served as a go-between for the counselors and the families. In others, I had to try and convince the counselors that the plans of my friends were really based on serious thinking. As our old Archbishop Stefan once said, those who believe will be stopped by nothing. But there are those also faint of heart who only love can help. Yes, when I think of some in the camp, it seems that there is no love strong enough to reach out and pull them back into life. I can see them passing before my window, beards unshaven, eyes troubled with drink, walking from their room to the canteen, and from the canteen back to their room. They are those who have shut their hearts because when everything failed, they were too afraid to go on living, but were too frightened to die. These men and women for whom forgetting is the only consolation, there is perhaps no other way to be helped than by letting them look at someone who might be more miserable even than they.
How can you talk of a future? You, a cripple, a useless fellow.
Yes, perhaps there is nothing for me. But you are not crippled. You could still try. And sometimes they laugh. Sometimes they go away silent. May God help them in their loneliness. We have been told that if we get enough help, that the camp could disappear by next year. And I hope for a small flat with simple furniture, a balcony, a bathroom, in one of the new houses built by the United Nations. I shall take with me my icon of the Holy Trinity, the prayer book my father gave me, the photograph of Julia, and all the letters I have received from friends, those who have left the camp, and those who helped us. My life in the camp will then be over, a life that began 13 years ago when I gazed over the mountains and made my decision to stand by the things in which I believe. Nicholas Mitotich died early in December 1958, a few weeks before he could leave the camp. His bishop said of him, he was a light amongst his people.
You have been listening to Albert Dekker as Mitotich. The program was produced by Gerald Keane and Eric Valters, text written by Stanley Wright, with songs and music recorded in refugee camps in different parts of Europe. This has been a presentation of United Nations Radio in cooperation with the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.